He's considered the greatest broadcaster in wrestling history. And now, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross brings his legendary voice and his famous friends to the podcast world. Welcome to the Ross Report.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome. This is Slobber Knocker Audio. Are you ready? Are you really ready to roll? I want to thank you folks for joining us. Thanks for spreading the word and downloading the Ross Report. And thank you for helping make our program, and I'm talking ours as in yours and mine, a top 10 rated iTunes sports and recreation chart podcast in the world. Our team is getting it done, folks, and you are a big reason why. Great show today with my former broadcast partner, Tony Schiavone. He doesn't do a lot of these, and we got a lot of ground to cover. We're going to do so very, very quickly. Now, got a few things on my mind. No surprise there, huh? Let's start off with WWE. Seems like the Brock Lesnar-Paul Heyman duo are leading the way. Lesnar, the new WWE World Champion. I talked about that last week in my SummerSlam review. And I've never seen a incumbent champion like John Cena get dominated as he was at SummerSlam like Brock Lesnar did. I read, I think it might have been in the Wrestling Observer, that the last time on record that some of the old-timers, actually before my time, and I wasn't in that area, but apparently Bruno Sammartino beat Waldo Von Erich in such a way, but the roles were reversed. Bruno was the babyface and Waldo was the heel, and it was a big, big angle, and Bruno came out for revenge and just dominated his opponent in that championship match, you know, all those years ago. But, you know, WWE's making Lesnar a beast. I've said that here. It's a good idea. In the theory of the traveling NWA champion, the champion does not have to be on TV every week. If you can figure out creative ways to keep the champion represented, whether it be in video packages, vignettes, or through the great Paul Heyman's mouth, it can be done. Lesnar does not have to be on TV on a regular basis to maintain his aura. As a matter of fact, if you only see Lesnar wrestle on pay-per-view or on the WWE Network, and you know what that costs, then that works for me. It really does. So the Lesnar-Heyman duo are right now, they're the straw that's stirring the drink in WWE, no doubt about it. Heyman, by far, the best talker in all the business. And he's going to, with the work he's doing right now, he's going to go down in history as one of the great all-time orators ever. And there have been a lot of great talkers. For this generation who have grown up with Paul Heyman, he's going to be your number one guy, and I'm not going to argue with you about that, but Paul will tell you himself, he's not the first great talker in the business, but he may be the greatest of all time before it's all said and done in the business. So then you got, you know, you're wondering who's going to step up. Who's going to step up and who's going to step up and be the next guy? Well, it's obvious that WWE is working on Roman Reigns to be the next it guy. And it's funny to me that a lot of people are, sometimes they don't have any patience. Is Roman Reigns ready to be the top new flag bearer, face off, the top baby face in the WWE today? No. As a matter of fact, hell no. He's not even close. But does he have the potential? Does he have the look, the animal magnetism, the it factor to become that someday? Well, I think so. Obviously, WWE thinks so. But it's going to be up to WWE's creativity. It's going to be up to their internal coaching and mentoring. And it's going to be up to Roman Reigns to expand his game, add things to his repertoire. He can't be like a football team that can only run the ball and can't throw. He's got to have a well-rounded game that has to evolve for him to get to the promised land that he wants. So is Roman Reigns ready? No. But should he be castigated and criticized in social media because he's not ready? Well, absolutely not. That's embarrassing. It's ignorant. How can a kid that young be refined? He is a work in progress. He needs time to get better. I think athletically, he has all the skill set to be a great in-ring performer. It's going to be the intangibles, the nuances, adding things, and not getting in a rut, not memorizing a handful of moves. But he's got to become diverse, and he's got to evolve. I think he will. Interesting that the Seth Rollins Money in the Bank issue, interesting matter to me because Rollins is the heel. And he's a guy that I don't see going after cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase, his contract, against Brock Lesnar. Now, maybe that's what I should think, and then maybe WWE will creatively throw their curveball and arrange somehow that does occur. I don't see it happening, but it might. And if it does, well, then it would be an interesting scenario. But I just don't feel that that's on the horizon or anytime soon. But would it make Rollins look bad if he used the briefcase for somebody else? Or do you plant the seed that Rollins says at the next pay-per-view that I could cash in my contract and make the whole storyline more interesting? It could happen. But I'm interested about the Money in the Bank situation right now because it's got me scratching my head, which I think is a good thing. You got to wonder with John Cena after SummerSlam, after missing the next night on Monday Night Raw, is John Cena going to slowly begin to evolve his longstanding persona? I think John could serve himself better, really well, by making a few subtle changes. Does John Cena need to make wholesale changes? Absolutely not. But to make subtle changes, get a little bit more edge to his character and his persona, maybe tweak his ring attire somewhat, maybe I think that's a good idea. Certainly something for WWE and Cena to consider. I think it's time, and I don't think the changes have to be major. Interesting thing to have Dean Ambrose leave just as he was getting really relevant to go do a WWE film. That might have been the idea. You leave when you're hot. You come back, you're still going to be pretty damn hot. Hope it serves everybody well in the long haul. Should be some nice new money for Dean Ambrose, and that's not a bad thing, never a bad thing. And maybe the movie will be a hit and will help him become a bigger star in WWE. The kid's got something. I said the other night he reminds me a little bit of Terry Funk. He's always reminded me of Brian Pillman. He's got a little bit of that edgy, unpredictable Roddy Piper in him. Those are all really, really good traits for Dean Ambrose to have. And I think there's big money in Ambrose. And maybe if Reigns doesn't evolve and WWE sees that Reigns isn't evolving by the time the Royal Rumble rolls around, who knows? Maybe Ambrose is your guy for Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 31. I'd love for WWE to reduce the number of uncreative, repetitive distraction finishes. They get old. And talents are made to look sometimes really dumb. Somebody's music plays, and they're in the middle of a game, let's say. That'd be like on a football field. And I get it. They're an entertainment entity. They're not a sport. But they take you out of your disbelief when you're playing and the other team's fight song plays and you quit playing. That don't happen. So these distraction finishes are getting repetitive. And the more repetitive a finish of any kind gets, the lesser it means. I'm anxious to see what WWE's marketing brain trust comes up with any new ways to market the WWE network outside the box to specific demographics. And how do you find specific demographics and then market a phase of your network to that appeal to that demo. It's like watching I watch the Food Network a lot, and I notice a lot of the sponsors on the Food Network are other foods. Makes sense, right? That's target marketing. For example, what if every WWE superstar who has a Twitter account sends out at least one tweet a day on what they are watching on the WWE Network? It would help, and it's a no-cost, simple way to reach those talents' loyal fan base, also known as Twitter followers. I'd like to know what John Cena watched yesterday, or what Brock Lesnar watched on the network, or Paul Heyman, or Dolph Ziggler, the Intercontinental Champion. So what's wrong with that idea? I still like my idea, speaking of ideas, the double retirement match at WrestleMania 31 for The Undertaker versus Sting, especially if WWE is not going to use Jerry Jones' AT&T Stadium in Dallas for WrestleMania 32, of which I don't know, by the way. I don't know that they're not. Now, if WWE were then if they were going to use the stadium, then they could make the WrestleMania 31 match between Taker and Sting just simply the loser retires match. And then I would put Taker over, and then Taker would have his advertised and highly promoted last match of his fabled career in his home state of Texas in Dallas, and I'd try, if I were WWE, to top the 100,000 fans in attendance mark for that WrestleMania, which would have a strong Undertaker retirement theme. It all depends on Taker's health, of which I don't know the updates, if Taker could come back this year, much less in 2 years. A lot of this. But if everybody was healthy and the field was level, it would be a hell of a scenario for two WrestleManias. Gives you two great attractions for the next two WrestleManias to help you build the rest of your card around. And I would certainly have the Undertaker at WrestleMania 32 in the last match on the show if it was going to be definitely his retirement match, and it would be against the hottest guy in the territory, whoever that may be at that time. And I'm not so sure it wouldn't be title versus retirement. And I'll tell you more about that concept in the end of the day. And yes, Undertaker would win. He would win the title, and he would retire, which creates a whole new ball game, and it pushes the restart button for who's going to be the next WWE World Champion. I got a few more thoughts for you. A few more things on my mind. During that little commercial break, I had a little sip of my Route 44 Sonic Diet Peach Tea. So if you had, JR's going to mention Sonic at least once in his show in the office pool, you win. Yeah, I've been a Sonic customer for my whole life. They're an Oklahoma company. And I'd love them to be a sponsor here on our show. I'm just blatant. How about that? I'm shilling. I'm blatant. But when you're reaching over 500,000 downloaders a week, and even in our part two of our Sting show reached, I think, 1.2 million downloads on that show, I think we could get a lot of traffic into Sonic because I believe in the product. So maybe someday some executive in Oklahoma City, in my home state, will give us a shot at sponsoring Sonic here on the program. At least I'm not beating around the bush. Nothing subtle about me. Looking at more news items, the TNA Impact, I've heard nothing as I talk today on the TV front on whether or not Impact is staying with Spike or not. They moved to Wednesday. I actually think that was a good move. Get your ass away from the NFL football season. WWE's got to battle it heavily enough, and it has an effect on you, on your ratings, and which has an effect on your psyche. We battled it all the time, man, when I was on Monday Night Raw. Some of you may remember that I used to appear on Monday Night Raw every Monday night, and Monday Night Football was a big challenger. And so if you can stay away from football, like now CBS is going to be carrying NFL football on Thursday. Get the hell away from it. Too many males are watching TNA, and then they got to make a decision to watch a wrestling show or a big game, especially one featuring their favorite team. Why fight that battle? So on that case, moving to Wednesday is a good idea for TNA and Spike. How it was handled at the last moment was a little perplexing, but I don't know all the details on that. But nonetheless, I have heard nothing of a new TV deal. You got to wonder what's going to happen to the brand if they do not have an American cable TV outlet. I hope they survive. I said that many times, but if TNA Impact does not have an American television outlet, their days are numbered. Let's just tell it like it is. I don't like it. I hope it doesn't happen, but it's real. I don't think TNA can survive very long without an American television outlet. Oh, wait, they got shows in the UK. They got shows around the world. They can those shows won't pay all the bills, folks. They help. They're nice to have. They're great for the fans in those countries, but they won't pay the tab, at least all the tab. I know one thing. If they do go out of business, a lot of talents are going to be looking for work, and I wonder if WWE would take any free agents. The general consensus within the wrestling business is that answer is no. My philosophy on that is I think that's a mistake. WWE's got a very young roster that needs to get better. The only way that a rookie or young wrestler can get better is to wrestle someone on a regular basis at the live events that are better than the rookies. If you've got two rookies wrestling each other on the road and you're dumb enough to book that match, then you should not be surprised when your rookies don't get better. So bottom line, for a rookie or young talent to get better, they need to, as much as possible, on a regular basis, compete with those that are better than the rookies. And there are some excellent, fundamentally sound, really good talents in TNA that could help some of the young rookies in WWE and younger talents in general become better in the ring. And that's the bottom line. I've used that twice now. I must have Austin on my mind. We have had some good talk. We got some interesting plans for the future, by the way. I'll tell you those when the time comes. So until TNA reestablishes its American cable TV home, I encourage them to steer the course, to play to their strengths, which I believe is their bell-to-bell product, from a very underrated talent roster. I really like Impact's roster. I like a lot of things about it. I think that they are some of them are underutilized. You put them and play them to their strengths. When I think of X Division, I think of high-flying, cruiserweight things, and nothing wrong with that. I grew up in a junior heavyweight territory in Oklahoma with the great Danny Hodge. But Samoa Joe, last I looked, was the X Division champion. I love Samoa Joe. I think he's really hasn't even scratched his potential. But I don't see him as an X Division guy. So while some on the internet think that I'm an enemy of TNA Impact, and there may be some in Nashville that think I'm an enemy, well, you're wrong. Nothing could be farther from the truth. If one is truly a wrestling fan, and by God I am, then why would any sane person want any wrestling organization to fail? It makes zero sense, and I do not have an agenda. In Ring of Honor, nothing really much new here. Kevin Steen, as many of you know, left, watched his final match with Steve Corino the other day on TV out of Oklahoma City, their Fox affiliate. God, Sinclair's got some good affiliates in their network. I just wish they would realize that they're not monetizing their brand as they could. Kevin Steen now in WWE developmental. I hope that he makes it. I like him. I hope he's not completely reinvented. Doesn't need to be completely reinvented. He's a hell of a brawler. Kind of reminds me of a little bit of Mick Foley. You know, there's other brawlers that he resembles. He's a good brawler who needs to address his look a little bit, which he's doing, and I appreciate that. And his overall conditioning has got to be really, really good, and that'll be aggressively addressed in Orlando at the Performance Center. But you got to love Steen's natural instincts. You can't teach that. He's got natural instincts. And he will become a better talent after going through the Performance Center, just like Sami Zayn has. Sami Zayn came in highly ballyhooed, one of the top independent wrestlers in the world. No argument here. But he's gotten better since he's been in Orlando, and that's a good thing. So I still think it makes sense for Ring of Honor to be happy to promote themselves as the organization that produces major stars, such as CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, and Samoa Joe and Cesaro, and etc. That's not a bad thing. Let me tell you something else that's not a bad thing. Tony Schiavone, my longtime broadcast partner from the days of the Jim Crockett promotion era into WCW. He's doing baseball now and all kinds of things. And this is going to be a fun show for those of you that used to watch Tony and I on TBS, the Clash of Champions, the WCW pay-per-views, and everything. We'll catch up with what Tony's doing, how his family's doing. And I'm really excited and looking forward to this. And we'll kick it off with Tony Schiavone when we come back.
The Ross Report with Jim Ross.
We're back on the show here, the Ross Report. Slobberknocker Audio, ladies and gentlemen. It is the real deal. Hey, we were talking about the WCW thing. And there's a lot of stuff to get into about that. But okay. One thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, when I had Eric Bischoff on here, on the podcast, he was very good, and we did really well. He's changed over the years, and he's sure. You know, we all change. Some, and I thought that he'd changed for the better. I got along with Eric fine when he came to WWE. You know, he told me the story that Herd hired him so that it would make you and I uncomfortable.
Yeah, I've heard that story too. That was Jim Herd's way of managing a company.
Boy, that's not a very positive philosophy to me.
No, it's not.
But maybe it's done all the time anyway. But
right,
you know, but he was, you know, that was what he told me. And I thought that was kind of interesting. That just stirred up.
Yeah, I know. I remember. I've heard that story too.
Did you, if you looked at Herd and Kip Fry, and Eric and Watts, is there any? The Jim Herd, obviously, not a Herd guy.
No, not at all.
And I got along with him better than most, and it's simply because, I tell people this, I was not married.
Right.
And he would invite me to go to dinner, and he would pick up the tab.
Right.
And it was on Ted. Ted Turner was buying the booze and the food.
Right.
You know, he didn't go to, you know, some diner. He always went to good places to eat. You know, you got to.
You like bones.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, y'all go. Yeah.
The only time I went out with Jim Herd was when we were in Japan that time. You remember that?
Yeah.
We all ended up in the Korean bar.
Yeah.
That's the only time I went out with him that I can remember.
I look around, and I'm preoccupied, and next thing I know, Herd's on the stage singing. Before karaoke. He was belting it out, man, or some rock and roll song, Johnny B. Goode or some Chuck Berry thing.
I headed to the bathroom. A Korean girl followed me to the bathroom. I'm like, what's going on here?
Are you sure it was a girl?
No. Because we were pretty shot at that time.
Oh, yeah, for that time.
Yeah.
Did you ever go up to Kip Fry's house up near Gainesville?
Yes, I did.
And write TV?
Yes, I did.
Didn't we do that on, like, Fridays?
I can't remember when we did it, Jim. I remember us going to the Dawsonville. We'd go to the Dawsonville pool room.
Yeah, for lunch.
Yeah. But I can't remember what day we did. I think we probably did do it on a Friday.
Because he didn't have to come into Atlanta on Friday. He'd stay at his weekend retreat.
Right.
Speaking of Kip Fry.
Kip had a very different vision for the business, and I got along with him okay.
Yeah, I did too. He had a lot of really cool, good traits. He had good people skills.
Yep.
He just didn't have product knowledge.
No, not at all.
And so he was sometimes zoomed by the last guy I talked to.
Yeah.
And then they brought in Bombastic Bill, the big cowboy.
Yes, they did. I thought at that time that Bill would hate me. But Bill and I ended up being pretty good friends. And, you know, when I look back on it, Jim, Bill really taught me a lot about the business as the business should be.
Mm-hmm.
And he would take the time. And up until then, of all the bosses I had in the business, I remember at Center Stage one time, he was saying, here's why I want you to sell this match this way. And he explained it to me. And I remember as I walked away from that meeting thinking, no one's ever done that.
Yeah.
No one has ever sat down and told me, this is the way we want you to sell it, and here's why we want you to sell it. And I really appreciated that. So,
I got that every day because he broke me in.
Yeah.
He was a guy that I met in college, and he basically hired me to be McGurk's driver because Leroy was blind,
mm-hmm.
and Bill wanted him out of his hair, so he gave him, you know, I was the boy Friday.
Do you remember the Monday meetings?
Yeah.
That we had there? They were terrible. But here was the thing about it is, and this is a true story, I remember thinking every time I went to those meetings, thank God I'm not Jim Ross, because he would watch the Saturday night show, and he would jump on you and Paulie about the way you sold things.
Yeah.
And he would jump on Dan Bynum about the way things were edited or cut.
All right.
Okay, and he would just hammer your ass.
But there were good points, right?
And you would sit there and take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, sitting there, thank God he doesn't watch Worldwide, because we do the same stuff.
Yeah.
Those were brutal. To this day, I don't know how you dealt with that.
Well, he was a demanding guy. You know, people say, well,
yeah.
I said, think of what you know from ESPN Classic about Vince Lombardi.
Yeah.
And think of that character with those traits, being Southern, 6'3", 300, and being the big-time alpha male.
Right.
And that's Bill. But at the end of the day, it made me a better announcer.
Sure it did. No question it did. Those meetings were you and me and Bynum and Dusty, and I think Magnum TA was at that time at the beginning. Was in. That's what I remember about those meetings. I remember Bill would have this long yellow, you know, notepad full of notes that he took while watching WCW Saturday Night.
Those legal pads.
Yeah, that's one of those legal pads.
Yeah, and he used a very sharp pencil.
Yes.
He had an electric pencil sharpener before almost anybody. I remember the silliest things. It was a hell of a way to start the week, but that's what
it was.
You know,
yes, it was, man. And but those were interesting days. And I really, if they asked me about working with Bill Watts, I learned a lot. I did. Learned a hell of a lot about how things should be sold, and you know what you should do, and your thought process going. Because he was into that, so I kind of appreciated his working with him.
Tell me about your because you weren't there a long time, and I don't mean to be a wise ass. How long did you stay in WWE? Were you going 2 years or a year?
No, 1 year, almost 1 year exactly. I don't know if you remember this. You and I went to meet with Jim Herd and Jack Petrick.
Yeah.
And this is something my wife can vouch for this one. And I remember sitting down in that meeting with all of us, mm-hmm. and you, as only you can do, took over the freaking meeting, okay? And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, he's doing great. he's acting like an agent for himself and me, too. I'm not going to say a freaking word. And so when we got finished, they offered us money, and it was by far the biggest money for me in my life.
Yeah, and both of us got the same deal.
Right, got the same deal. Yeah. And I went back home, and Lois said, "How did it work out?" I said, "Jim Ross just got me $100,000," and we were like celebrating. And
in the same house you live in today.
Same house I live in today. Absolutely.
How cool is that?
And but I didn't want to work for Jim Herd. I really didn't. And Vince McMahon threw J.J. Dillon, and J.J. was working over there at that time, contacted me, and I went up there and worked up there for a year. And I'm telling you, if I think about it, it was probably the best year of my life in the business, because you know how small-time Crockett was back then.
Yeah.
This was really the big time compared to that. And just great staff, great people to work with. Some people up there who are still my friends on producers mm-hmm. that work up there. And it was a great year, and it was one of those things where, well, my wife thought it would be best us live back in the South, and We couldn't afford to buy a house up there because you know how much real estate is up there. And we had five young kids, five and under at that time. And so we went up and lived in Connecticut, up in Wilton, Connecticut for a year. And then I got a call back from Jim Barnett, wanted me to come back. And they met with me at the New York City Hilton. And they offered me a lot of money to come back. And it was the toughest decision of my life. And I came back. And as soon as I came back, I felt I'd made the worst decision of my life. And I laid on the couch in the house and cried. Because I thought my career was over because I had left the WWF, or now the WWE, and come back to this small-time stuff, working with Wayne Daniel again. Remember Wayne?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Wayne drive you crazy. So
fastest,
I loved him.
Fastest tape operator on the East Coast. He told me that at a bar one night.
I'm sure he did. That was his claim to fame.
He's on the fastest goddamn tape operator on the East Coast.
So I came back working here, and I was miserable, and I called Vince back immediately and said, I want my job back.
Uh-oh.
And he had Emily, who was his secretary at that time, call me back, and Vince said, no, you got five young kids. You just moved them from Atlanta to Connecticut and back to Atlanta. Stay where you are. It'll be best for your family. So I did, and hung out until the sheriff put the sign on the door.
Yeah, he did. Hey, that was a good run
for
this crazy business. And at the end of the day, even though the WWE was maybe more exotic, more refined, at the end of the day, you did raise five kids there and where you wanted. And,
right.
And in that whole deal, you lived in the same house that you must like that. You're there.
Right.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's...
Yeah, it's all turned out okay.
I used to say leaving WCW was... I used to really bemoan leaving Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
I really liked Atlanta. I thought that there was a lot of wins when I left there because it created opportunity for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to another place to see what opportunities awaited me.
Right.
When Eric was getting in his wheelhouse there and things were getting, talk about the Monday Nitro deal. How did you get the information that you guys are going to start doing a live broadcast every Monday night?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's kind of foggy. I just remember us being told that we're going to start doing a live show on Mondays, and I guess the first one was done at the Mall of America. And that's, if you'll recall, back then when we first started doing the Monday Nitros, Eric was doing the play-by-play, and Steve McMichael was one of the color men, and I think Keenan was with him too. I didn't start doing the Monday Nitros until they developed the NWO, and Eric wanted to take himself off because he was going to be an NWO member. But I remember we had meetings about it, and you know Craig Leathers was kind of running things back then, and was a part of it. And so I remember that happening. One thing I can tell you about this, I do remember the Thunder meeting because Eric brought us all together, and I mean, it was everybody in production, and he said, they want to do another show live for TBS. He said, but I've told them, no, we can't do it. There's no way we can do another live show. It would not be the right thing to do. And I remember Eric saying, well, I'm saying that now, but if Ted Turner wants another show, we're going to have another show.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Ted Turner did want another show, or somebody high up on another show because we ended up doing it, which I think helped the decline of what we did.
No doubt. It's the same. That's what's one of the ails of wrestling now is that there's too much product on television.
Yeah, exactly. And back then, not only was it too much product on television, it was too much Tony Schiavone. Because, you know, listen, Eric and I made my best money under Eric Bischoff, by far. He treated, you know, he could be tough at times and demanding like all bosses could in the wrestling business, I guess. But he was always fair with me, was good to me, was good to my family. And I made a ton of money under him. He depended on me for a lot of stuff. But seeing Tony Schiavone do your 3 hours of pay-per-view on a Sunday night and then do your 3 hours of Monday Nitro and then do your 2 hours of Thunder on Thursday or whenever we ended up having it, I guess it was Thursday, was just too much of me. And so everything got overexposed.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy at that point. It's not a matter of are you going to have burnout It's not a matter of just, is that going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen.
So anyway, those years with Eric were even though you know, near the end it was pretty bad for many reasons. I'm not blaming Eric, but it was very bad for many reasons. Overall, they were great years for us.
Did you?
My family.
Oh yeah, heck yeah. How close to the vest creatively did Eric and his inner circle keep the NWO thing? When did you know that the NWO reveal was going to occur?
Well, I remember that we knew that something big was going to happen, and they were not going to tell the announcers. How it is in wrestling, Jim.
Telephone, telegraph.
Nobody can keep a freaking secret.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it filtered down to us that, well, it might be Hogan coming out, joining the NWO. And I remember thinking, are you serious? Yeah, but they got to, because, you know, Hogan had his own deal back then, you know, had his own creative control. So they had to sell him to that, and he had to agree to it. And apparently, if I'm right, I may be wrong. Maybe people know more about it than I do. Maybe he didn't agree to it till later on in the show. But it was still kind of up in the air that he was going to, that there was going to be something big at the NWO and he was going to be a part of it.
Well, what about when Hall and Nash showed up? How much notice did you have before Hall and Nash came on the TV show?
I had no notice about Scott Hall because I don't remember that was making. He just kind of walked through. I had none about that.
So you just straight ad lib. Yeah. So the NWO guys come in. Hogan becomes the heel.
Right.
To me, Hall and Nash really built a fire. And then when Hogan turned heel and joined them, it was like this very flammable log that fell across and perfectly landed in the middle of the fire, and it just started burning.
Right.
And getting hotter and higher and hotter and higher.
Right.
I thought that was pure magic.
Hall,
Nash, and Hogan.
Yeah, it was well done to the point to where it was such a great thing that they had. I'm not so sure they knew what to do with it in the long run.
Well, it's obvious that, you know, sometimes less is more. I love the dynamic that was created by Hall, Nash, and Hogan.
Yeah.
I thought their chemistry in the ring on promos and being, you know, cool, wise-ass, kind of bullied, cool guys, you know. But when they started adding more and more people to the NWO, where it looked like, you know, the University of Georgia marching band out there.
Right.
God almighty.
Yeah, no. And then it became, the people they added to the NWO didn't really matter.
No.
Weren't over as those guys were.
No, and it diluted it. It diluted
I
thought.
I think at the beginning, Jim, I think it helped both sides. If you consider us one side and the WWE another side.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was an intrigue of Monday night about who would end up on our show or who would end up on your show. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that was good. It was good for the business. And if you look at the cumulative television rating for when Monday Nitro was hot and Monday Night Raw was chasing, there were a lot of people watching wrestling.
No question.
A lot of people watching wrestling.
And I still, you know, I still hear it today.
Well, yeah.
I know you do.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of people who, and I'm really am touched by it because to me it was a job. And I loved wrestling. I was a gigantic wrestling fan, and before I got into it, so it was a big thrill to me to finally meet Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat and the Anderson Brothers and all that. But I hear people today say, you know, you were the voice of my childhood.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened to, you know, and I'm flattered by that.
Yeah,
I really am.
Yeah, I get that. It is neat. It is neat. You know, I remember one night, and this came in my head right now. I just visualized it. You and I were working late one night at the office on the floor of the South Tower, right?
Right. That's exactly where it was.
And Ole was booking, and he was by himself. And he yelled at you and me, which was nothing unusual. And we went in, and it was like him having a little bit of writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us were fans, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And both of us had an emotional investment into the product because they were paying us.
Mm-hmm.
And you had five children.
Right.
And I had two ex-wives. So the money is already obligated out there. So I remember us sitting down and talking to Ole, maybe we gave him an idea or two, or you had one, or I might have had one. He got over the hump, and we all walked out together, and I said something about one of his Bandalon shirts. I don't know, just making a wise-ass remark, you know. I thought he was good. He grabbed me, man. I thought, oh shoot, he's gonna, I'm gonna be, he's gonna tear my guts out. But he wanted to, and he, in the old days, he probably would have stretched me or got me in something just to make you hurt for a little while, you know.
Yeah.
But he was a unique cat too, brother. Yeah. Well, what kind of chemistry did you and Bobby Heenan have?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's been a lot of things apparently written about that and talked about that. That Heenan and I really got along quite well, and it deteriorated. And I've heard that Heenan is online, I guess, and maybe in his book, from what the tweets I've seen, written a lot of bad things. And those are my fault. Those are not his. I really feel bad about the way it ended. And because when, you know, me and Tenay and Heenan and Lee Marshall would travel around all the time together.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all good friends. But then one day, near the end, and Jim, the day gets by me here, but Craig Leathers called me at the house. I was at home, and he said, we just fired Bobby Heenan. Because it got to the point to where Heenan wasn't doing Nitro anymore. It was me and I don't know who it was, but it wasn't Heenan. They weren't using him. And he was just doing the worldwide shows in the studio. He said, we've let him go. And I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no. He said, and he has threatened a lawsuit. He said, he threatened me with a lawsuit. So I'm telling you, as your boss, if Heenan calls you, do not talk to him. I said, okay. And me being a company guy, I ignored Bobby. I didn't call him. I didn't ask how he was. In hindsight, I should have said, okay, Craig, you're right. I won't talk to him, and then turn around and call him. That would have been the right thing to do if I was his friend. And Bobby was really ticked off about that, and he should have been. But if that was my fault, I should have never done that. And it's something that I've talked to Mike Tenay about since that time that I really feel bad about, because we were so close and we got along so well. I thought we worked well together, and so he was very angry at me. We got together in 2000. I'm thinking it's 2003. We went up to Cincinnati to do this after we folded, of course. Went up to Cincinnati to do a voiceover for a video game for Acclaim that none of us ever got paid for. And Bobby and I got together, and he talked to me. He laid it out to me that that, you know, he thought I was this, and I should have never done this. And there's a lot of people who didn't like me backstage. Jim, a lot of that was, I don't know, sometimes I'm in another world. A lot of that kind of escaped me. I didn't realize that was going on. So we kind of made up there, and I remember Bobby saying, call me, because Bobby's big into people calling him, staying in touch. This is before he had all the, I guess, all the throat problems he's had, or it just started. And I said, okay, I will, and I never called him again. So if he's angry at me, I deserve it, and I feel bad about it, because he truly was one of the great guys to work with.
Yeah, he was a fun guy. Well, it was just miscommunication, and that's probably the biggest common denominator in the downfalls of any issue in pro wrestling, and probably in life in general, is miscommunication.
Yeah, but I shouldn't have been a company guy then. I should have lied, and I should have said, yes, I won't call him, and call him and say, Brain, you doing okay? But that was the wrong thing to do. I mean, you should go with a friend. I've learned that now, and I feel bad about it. And it's one of those things I'm going to take to the grave with me. So any bad thing he says about me, I don't believe half of it from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like the Gorilla Monsoon thing, that's out there. And people say, did you not want him to mention Gorilla Monsoon that night? That was not true. What I did say that night was, he said, I'm going to mention Gorilla here. I said, let Eric know you were going to do that. He said, no, I'm going to do it. And I said, okay. I only questioned, you know, because what would happen was, if he would say something like that, Eric didn't want say Eric was flying to my shit later.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So that was the only way I questioned him. So I loved Gorilla Monsoon. We all did. Anybody who worked with me loved him. Was one of the great gentlemen of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things. But no, Heenan and I really got along. I thought we had great chemistry. I loved working with him. He was so funny.
Yeah.
Some of the funny things he did was actually when we traveled, and some of the things we did, because he would always pull jokes on people.
Yeah, he had as good natural comedic timing as anybody that I ever knew.
No question.
And you and I both worked with a lot of really good heel type, you know, announcers, good, right. Different levels, different approaches. But mm-hmm. Cornette is really quick-witted and funny and can be, very pointed and opinionated. Paul Heyman, same deal. Not quite as funny with Cornette's hee-haw humor, hee-haw and crack. And I always thought Cornette was really, really funny. Both of them are brilliant guys. But Bobby, this is probably going to get me thrown on the Twitter bus, but because everybody now loves Paul Heyman, because he's really the most significant manager left in the business that's on TV, right. And mm-hmm. he's damn good. Heyman's damn good. So I don't know that anybody will ever be better than Bobby Heenan as a heel manager turned commentator. And then the ones that go back farther, Tony, remember that he wasn't a bad worker.
No, he was very good. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I can remember seeing a match, and this was, I guess, right after he stopped working, but I was seeing a match, an old AWA tape, where it was maybe him and Lanza, possibly, or him and Bockwinkel against, Brunzel and a midget, a mixed tag match, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the bumps he took for that vertically challenged person.
Vertically
unbelievable. It was hilarious. It was so entertaining. He was tremendous. He really was. And you bring up his name and that, and it really makes me feel bad.
Well, when I went on the Twitter and asked, for questions, I got all these. Are you going to ask him about Heenan? Surely you're not going to go into the Heenan territory. And I'm thinking, what the hell are you talking about?
Right, and that's what it is. Apparently, Bobby's out there said a lot of things about me. I've never read it. I've never heard it myself. I just got it kind of secondhand.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it that's not true, but that's fine. I mean, if he wants to heap stuff on me, I deserve it because of the way I treated him at the end.
I can't think of how you could answer that question any better. Now I understand more about it than there was, because I didn't know. I haven't read the material or heard it either.
Yeah.
So right. I'm with you on that deal. How did you like working with Russo and Ferrara?
Jim, I'm all about somebody who puts the time and effort into what they're doing, and they did. And when they came in, they had put more time and effort into a show than I had seen in a long time, maybe ever. It was pretty organized, and I got along with them fine. I don't have anything bad thing to say about Vince Russo or Ed Ferrara at all.
Yeah,
they were both good to me. They both put up a heck of a lot of effort into it. And I know that, they were there when we started to decline, and there's a lot of finger pointing going on. I don't think you can really point at one person or a couple of people and say they're the reason WCW went down. It's more than just that. But, I got along with them okay.
The last Monday Nitro broadcast.
Right.
Did everybody there know going in to the day that was it?
That we would not have a job after that?
Yeah.
No, I don't think we did. I think we all, we were really kept in the dark a lot of ways. We all knew things weren't going well, and everybody was on edge, and our stuff wasn't good. But I don't think anybody really knew that we were done. But everybody kind of knew that this will be our last time together, Monday Nitro type deal. We didn't know if Vince would open up an Atlanta office. We didn't know if we just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of an odd feeling backstage there. I can tell you personally that I kind of felt relieved because it was really bad there at the end, and I just kind of there was a lot of the girls who worked the backstage, and they were crying and everything at the end. And somebody tweeted me and said, did you really feel upset that you were not able to say anything of proper goodbye on the final Nitro? Because we just kind of cut.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
And I didn't. I don't feel bad about that.
Wow.
I don't feel bad.
You were burned out at that point.
Yes, was. I was completely burned out. And I was not only was I burned out, Jim, my voice was going too. I mean, when you scream for 3 hours and then you scream for two more, and then you scream for two more. You pretty much give your voice hell. And I was completely burnt out. I was worthless.
And then you go home and scream at five kids. No, I'm kidding.
No, or get screamed at by a wife. But no, I was completely burned out. My work was shoddy. I didn't give a darn. I did tongue-in-cheek stuff all the time, and I thought it was hip and cool, but it wasn't, and it just didn't get over. So, yeah, I would have fired my ass, too.
How long before they processed everybody out of there?
They if I'm right, was the very next day, or maybe a Thursday, they said they wanted everybody there, the memo, everybody come to the WCAW offices, and they'll tell us what's going to happen. And we all went to the WCW offices, and that's when they said today's our last day. And they had somebody from the WWE there. And, of course, there was nobody there, any of our bosses there, to say good work. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of an HR thing. And here's another thing that not many people know. I had a coat and tie on that day. And I remember a lot of the people in the office were saying, hey, Shivani, you kind of dressed up to get kicked out the door. In reality, at 2 o'clock that afternoon, I had an interview with WSV Radio, so that's why I was dressed up.
There you go.
I got hired that day too. I've never gone a day without a job.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
You know, here's the irony of us talking is that, you know, I'm not sure. Was your first foray into WSV when you would sit in for me on Sunday nights when I was doing Falcon football?
Yes, it was at the old studio. Sure was.
Yeah. We had a pretty good little gig there because if I was out of town doing the Falcon Radio on WSB, then you would come in on Sunday night at 9 o'clock. The game would be over, but we'd be traveling or something, and you'd knock it out. And
now I'm a longtime best employee of Cox Media.
Yeah, good. Real quick here, just some quick answers on some of these things any favorite Dusty Rhodes memory, or just how would you describe the Dream?
The Dream was one of the funniest men I ever met. I travel with him sometimes. Sometimes he could be a surly old guy, but he always had me laughing.
He was he had great charisma. He could he could control a room, and you know he probably could have made a fortune as a television evangelist.
I don't think there's any question. I always thought there should have been a reality show about him.
Yeah, well,
if anybody had a reality show, it should have been him.
Not too late. You know, he's lost. I saw him last time I saw him, I was at WrestleMania 30, and it kind of scared me because he had lost so much weight. I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, you're Dusty sick, you know, because he used to eat anything and everything. So he just said, no, I've decided to lose some weight, and he's lost, you know, I saw him last time. He lost 30, 40 pounds.
Yeah.
And but he's doing well. He's coaching up the kids at WWE's Developmental Center, Performance Center, on promos.
That's good, because he had the best.
Yeah.
When he had good promos, they were the best.
Yeah.
You know, and he and Flair are the guys that kind of really got me into business, too. So I have a fond place in my heart for him.
Yeah,
they're the kind of guys that I had done some things for the Crockett's, and they both said, you know, this is a guy we can use.
Mm-hmm.
So they had an impact on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen any faction in your career better than the Horsemen? And I asked that in the light of if whatever your answer was the NWO a contender for that honor? Mm-hmm. Best faction.
No, I think the Horsemen became the best faction ever. The reason I say that is because of longevity. I think you still have people put up those four fingers, and I think most everybody still knows what that is.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think longevity thing is a big deal. I'm that way. This on the titles. When people talk about, Ric Flair is a 16-time champion, that's impressive. But it's really impressive when we both worked in WWE once upon a time. The record that Bruno Sammartino had, where he held the title like 9 years,
right?
Something crazy, you know, something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But to me, the tenure, the length of your tenure, is more significant. A trivia note. than how many times he's won and lost. Because if you're a 16-time champion, that means you're a 15-time loser.
Right.
I mean, reality, right?
Right.
Just do the math. So
exactly.
It's not a bad thing, but it's not as embraceable as we think. Tell me about your TNA experience. But did you do like two shows or something?
Did one. Well, I guess I did do two shows, but I went there one time. I was working for WSB at that time, and Vince Russo had contacted me, asked me to go. He had an idea for me at TNA, would I go with them? So I got in a meeting with him and Disco Inferno. and a couple other guys who I can't remember at this time. We drove to Nashville from Atlanta, which is about 3.5 hours, did the show at, I don't know, this old building in Nashville, wherever it was. And I went in and I did this thing with Tanae, did this little angle with Tanae, and I guess I did a closing interview in the show, the next show. And, Jim, I remember...
Were they going to make you a heel?
Yeah, maybe a heel. Oh. Yeah, I turned heel on Tanae. But I do remember... There was one line that I was so proud of. I was more proud of than anything else that I had done on those two TNA shows. And that's when Tanae and I guess it wasn't Taz, it was whoever.
Don West?
Don Wilson? Yeah, Don West.
Don West.
Don West pitched to me at the end of the show, let's go backstage or wherever. And I was talking to Russo and all those guys back there, all the heels. I was going to do the heel interview, right? And let's go back to Tony Schiavone standing by. And I said, thank you very much, David Crockett and Johnny Weaver. And I was so proud of that line. That so anyway, but I was in the back there watching the monitor, and I was working for WSB, and I was working morning drive, which I still do for WSB. So I got to get up early. So I knew that I would have to drive back from Nashville and go right straight to the radio station to work, where I now have my job. And I remember listening to Mike and Don scream and shout about every lousy bump that was made and thinking to myself, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
I cannot do this anymore. I told Jeff Jarrett that night, and I told Vince on the way back, I said, I appreciate the opportunity. They paid me. I got my check. I said, but I'm not coming back. I've got to try something else. I got to go in another direction. I've got a chance here to do something else. I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
And I was getting ready to start, to do Braves pregame show on the network and a postgame show on the Braves radio network, which I was excited about because I think that was like in January and we were getting ready to start another season. I was going to be going down to spring training. And I just that was it.
You've established that you are always a wrestling fan, which is great. So was I.
Right.
But if I had my druthers and someone would have said, hey, look, you can still be a wrestling fan, JR, but would you rather have done wrestling broadcasting or been a longtime voice of the Oklahoma Sooners.
Right.
Anybody knows me, they're going to know the answer. I'm going to the football game.
Right.
I'm going to do football. And it has nothing against them. I'm turning my back on the wrestling fans. No, I would have liked to have done football for a living. But now you're doing the Gwinnett Braves, the AAA
right.
team, AAA
mm-hmm.
team of the Braves. You're the voice of that team. You got your spot in the booth. Everything.
Yeah, this is my sixth year doing it. I love it. And here's one of the reasons I love it. I was talking to a couple of players. I really get along with the players. They're the age of my kids. When I first started in baseball, Jim, players were my age. Now they're the age of my kids.
Wow.
So one of the players was the coach, Marty Reed, who's our pitching coach, one of the great guys in baseball. He said, go to the major leagues. I said, well, I've done a couple of major league games. I did a couple of major league Braves spring training games on the Braves network a couple years back.
Yeah.
I've done a couple, if you can consider that. It's not in the major league stadium. It was down in Jupiter, Florida. So he said, don't you want to go to the big leagues? I said, you know what? I said, I get by with so much crap here that I say on the air, and I can make mistakes here on the air, and nobody calls me on it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if I was doing the big leagues, they would, you know, the Twitter world would light up. Did you hear what Schiavone said? The mistake he made? So I really enjoy what I'm doing. I make a good living, and I put enough jobs together to where I make a good living.
Yeah.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Is the travel reminiscent at times when you're packing a bag and making sure you got all your equipment and all this other stuff? Does it bring back some of those wrestling memories of the travel?
Yeah, it does. But here's what it brings back. It brings back the memories of me going to Atlanta and you coming from Dallas for 8 days at a time. And I think that's kind of like what we did. We would be a week in Atlanta and a week home.
Yeah.
And because we're gone at 8 days at a time.
$35 a day, buddy.
Yeah.
That's like farting through silk. That is smooth stuff right there.
You know, the 1 year that I spent with Vince, I flew on Vince's charter back and forth to TV, and that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good trip.
Yeah. So that's kind of like that. But back in the WCW days, in those days, it was like travel was pretty brutal because we would fly somewhere on, let's say on Saturday to do a Sunday pay-per-view, fly back Tuesday morning to Atlanta and then fly back on Wednesday somewhere to do Thunder live on Thursday. But when it was live, that didn't last long, of course. But that's how the travel was at one time.
Yeah,
that was pretty brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. That's brutal.
Yeah.
Here recently, one of the guys that we know real well made his appearance first time in official capacity, because I don't know how official it is. But Sting is the character in the WWE 2K14 or 2K15, I should say, video game that's coming out in October. And if you pre-order it, you get both versions of Sting. You get the Surfer Sting type character, as they describe it, and the Dark Sting, the black and white Sting, like the the Crow Sting. So if you order the video game in advance, pre-order, you get the Sting character for free. So now they're trying to figure out, is Sting going to have a match at WrestleMania or wherever? And I've been saying here on this show, if you don't overthink it, then you know that there's got to be a way to shoot an angle and have a match with Sting with something that's meaningful for WrestleMania 31, which is next year's WrestleMania. And maybe it's his last match. My point is, I don't find it to be challenging to comprehend the fact that one could create a good storyline that could culminate with Sting's last match at WrestleMania 31 and it not have to be the focal point of the entire pay-per-view.
Right.
That makes sense to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely does.
See, I believe, like you said earlier, I believe that Sting has earned the right to have a WrestleMania moment.
Right.
And no matter what, you talk to all the guys about their monies or whatever, their toys they bought, their bling, whatever. The deal is that everybody, all the boys, when they get together, you'll always hear a WrestleMania story because it's so important in the fabric of the business in general.
Right.
So I think that he deserves it, and I hope that he gets that opportunity. You can't.
Well, I got to work two of them, so that's exciting.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely, and my first one was wearing a toga.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't try to get me to go commando, not wear any underwear. He said it'll impress Vince.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, if the wind blows my toga up above my waist, it's not going to impress anybody.
Well, you know why Enid told you that, don't you?
Well, of course I knew.
He was going to make sure it did glue up.
Without question, I was going to be—I was going to be pantsed, so to speak. I was going to be togued. So, I was going to get it. So I wore the tidy whitey Hanes pack of three type thing on that deal. So it was good. How do you think that the college football playoff system is going to work? Are you looking forward to it?
I don't know. The 15, the 16 are going to complain about it, aren't they?
Yes, sir.
That they weren't in the top four?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. To me, it's the same thing, just repackaged.
I like the fact that they try to do something different, number one.
Yeah.
I like the fact that there's that magic Final Four term.
Right.
And the six, I think that they're going to discover that they don't have enough teams. I think you're going to need eight teams.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it'll ever go to 16. I kind of think not. Just my own thing. I don't know. I might be wrong. But I think that eight teams would be a good number. Why they pick four, I don't know.
I think we are going to see, and they just have, they're in the midst of the SEC media days down in Birmingham or Hoover, Alabama, where all the coaches go down, and Mike Slive, who's the head of the SEC, goes down. They're talking about the top five conferences. I think you're eventually going to see, I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's basically going to be the top five conferences vie for the national championship. They're going to be breaking apart from the NCAA and have their own thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. Yeah. And the rich will get richer.
Right.
Oklahoma just announced almost a $400 million stadium renovation project that isn't designed to increase attendance. They're going to close one of the ends of the stadium in. They're going to add all these amenities. These little mini suites and these little all these different amenities for the consumer, because they're going to continue to ask you for more money. I have six season tickets at Oklahoma football. The waiting list is like 20 years or something.
Right.
I have six, and my six tickets are in my will, as to who they go to.
Right.
because it's a valuable asset.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. To me, it's the greatest sport. It really is. I mean, and I love baseball. Baseball is my passion. Baseball I love, but Georgia football at my house with my kids and my wife, of course, the kids are grown up now, but two kids graduated from UGA. I mean, we are like 12 months out of the year football fans. We follow recruiting. You know, we'll follow, you know, how the team is doing, what's going on with the coach.
Yeah.
And I'm good friends with the coach, so that helps out a great deal. I can go in up to his office anytime I want and sit down and talk to him. And
that's cool.
I just absolutely good.
There's
nothing like it. I know you would agree.
Yep.
There's nothing like that first Saturday when the team hits the field.
No,
and the marching band's playing.
No,
there's
great.
No feeling like that in the world.
Well, listen, you're staying busy. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I know the fans enjoyed this. I hope they enjoyed it as much as I did. You know, we could do this once a year, twice a year, but we had I think we had a good run. I got no ill regrets about anything that we did. You know, it all.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we've had good lives.
Yeah. And Jim, I've always valued your friendship. I really have. I just feel bad that we haven't stayed in touch as much as we should. But as I told you earlier, I feel that bad about that way with a lot of my friends in the business. But hopefully this will be the beginning of us staying in touch. And
well,
I saw a lot of questions on Twitter that we probably didn't get to answer. But, you know, I'm at Tony Schiavone 24. That's me. And I'll answer any question they want.
Tony Schiavone 20, the numeral 24.
Yeah, the number 24.
Who's that, Willie Mays?
No, that was the age I was when my first child was born.
Oh.
How about that?
That's my ATM number. What? Oh, wait a minute. Can we edit that out? 20. I thought it might be a ball player's number. Well, I'm glad that we got to do this, and I appreciate everybody hanging with us, I appreciate you so much for coming on, and we'll do this again.
All right, Jim. Anytime, buddy. Thanks. Great talking to you.
Okay, thanks, buddy. Man, I can't tell you how much fun I have had this week on the Ross Report. I say this all the time, but I hope that if you had half as much fun listening to this show as I did talking to my old friend Tony Schiavone, then I am a very pleasant, plump Oklahoman. It was a great pleasure to catch back up with Tony, and he's doing great. His first love was always baseball. He's living it. It's ironic that, as we said, he's a sports director at WSB Radio in Atlanta. And Atlanta was the home, WSB was the home of the Ross Report back in the day. Or Wrestling with Jim Ross, I'm sorry. This is the Ross Report. But Wrestling with Jim Ross, I thought it was a very creative title that they gave me. I bought the airtime for that show. Came on at 9 o'clock on Sunday nights. And we may be making those shows available to the fans. We're working on that concept right now, on how best to market those one-hour call-in shows back in the day in the early 90s. But great having them this week. Next week, we're going to have one of the greatest of all time. Doesn't do a lot of these podcasts, but man, oh man, there has never been anyone any tougher. I mean, a relentless competitor. I saw him in his very early days. He became one of the greatest American stars in the history of Japanese wrestling. I know I can't get to everything you're going to want to hear in the podcast next week, but we're going to give it a hell of an effort because I'm going to be talking to Stan the Man Hansen. Stan the Lariat Hansen next week right here on the Ross Report. It should be a classic because Stan's been out of the business. He's not got anybody's ass to kiss. He's going to tell us the truth. I'll prepare like a Trojan workhorse for Stan Hansen next week. So it's a lot of great things are going on. Just got to say thanks to all you guys for downloading and supporting the Ross Report. You do it every week. We grow and we grow and we grow. We got more and more people downloading. You help us when you tell your friends about it and you share what you've heard. You use your social media. You tweet it out. Let people know what you like. Let me know what you like and what you don't like. Let me know what you want to hear and who you want to hear from at JRSBBQs on Twitter. Next week, Stan Hansen. We got Cowboy Bill Watts coming up, Magnum TA, Vince Russo, Ed Ferrara, J.J. Dillon. Mark Madden, former WCW broadcaster. Both the Hardys, Jeff and Matt Hardy. We got an all-star lineup, and I'm working on some more guests. We are going to roar through the fall here on the Ross Report, and we want you to be with us every step of the way. So until I talk to you next week, thank you again so much for downloading the Ross Report. Please be sure and share the information with a friend and use that Amazon link when you're doing your shopping. Until then, do something nice for somebody tomorrow, and remember that our tomorrows are not guaranteed. Have a slobber knocker of a day, be tougher than a government mule, and I'll talk to you next week.